Douglas Pike shared Mr. Bick's questioning.
Pike was fairly set out, kind of set out to do, just to write a popular history of the Vietnam War. And I think he did do that successfully. And I think you're talking about two different media, for one thing. It's very difficult to compare a television series with a book. I think that Stanley's history is popular Vietnam history. That's what he set out to do. That's what he did. And where I might argue that's not what he should have done, that's really an unfair criticism. If someone writes a musical comedy, it's unfair to say it's a grand opera. All the teaching materials, all the audio or the classroom materials that supplied with this, I found to be really quite bad. They're even worse, I think, than in some ways the television series was itself. In part, it's a kind of left-wing ideological theme that runs through it. But in part, there's just massive ignorance by Pat Cohen just didn't know what he was doing.
All of these criticisms of the series as historical study and as teaching instrument lead to even more pressing queries about the historical analogies and applications taught by Vietnam, a television history. Which leads to our final question, perhaps the question which touches us most directly today. What are the lessons of Vietnam as taught by the series?
But my feeling about the PBS series is that it has a woven thesis all the way through it that tries to persuade its watching audience and listening audience that somehow America's involvement in Vietnam was immoral from the outset and predestined for defeat, which is just the opposite of what was true, in my judgment, with Ho Chi Minh talking about freedom and independence. And where's the freedom and where's the independence in the communist slave camp in South Vietnam today? Just the opposite is what was really happening. And yet, after several years of being told this on the American news night after night, I think it would be tragic if what goes down in the history books is that our involvement was immoral. Our involvement was not immoral. We were supporting our friends. And we were opposing our enemies. And what can be immoral about that?
The lessons of Vietnam are many. One quite obvious lesson, you have to have public support of the public and the Congress if you want to get involved in that sort of action again. In fact, it's now as a result of the misreading and misunderstanding of the whole Vietnam experience that it's difficult, for example, to get the support that is needed for the government in El Salvador to compete with the communist insurgency. And we've got 55 U.S. advisors down there, and this is considered to be sort of massive U.S. intervention by some people. Whereas right now, next door in Nicaragua, for example, there are 9,000 Cubans, 3,000 of whom are military advisors, and we've got a few hundred Soviets and other East Europeans. Nobody talks about that. The focus is all on a relatively small number of American advisors who are not going to combat down there. So this is a direct result of the so-called Vietnam syndrome. That it's difficult for the United States to get involved in any area, not even so remote. And as you've heard the President say, Central America is not that remote from the United States. So it's, and it has the additional I'd say more disadvantage. It carries with it an additional danger, is that it could lead the Soviets to believe that they can go into certain areas that may turn out to be in our interest, prevent us from going into it with impunity. It's long as with this, they feel they felt they've had more of a free hand. And look at the record. After the fall of Vietnam, the Soviets got involved massively in Angola, Ethiopia, and in Yemen, for example, not massively, but certainly involved there. And then finally we have Afghanistan. I mean, they felt with the current mindset in the United States that they can get involved in these operations with impunity, or relative impunity. I think they're cautious. I mean, they're not going to get directly involved in an area that they think we may have to react. But still, it's changed the whole psychological atmosphere in their favor, which they quite openly admit that this is a, plus the improvement in their military postures also played a role in all of this.
For the Vietnamese and the peoples of Laos and Cambodia, the legacy is a heritage of uprootedness, suffering, and fear.
There's an incredible cost involved in our defeat, if you will, our failure to continue to pursue the war in Vietnam. I think that you can see that cost in the eyes of these thousands of people that have forced to flee their societies. I think that hopelessness can be traced to our failure to fulfill the design, the goals, the objectives of our policy. I think it was a noble policy, a noble commitment. We were trying to preserve for them the option of their own way of life, of their own culture. And those cultures are threatened or have been changed radically today as a result of what transpired. And to me, that human cost, the human dimensions of that tragedy are something that I believe that we must continue to come to terms with. We must understand it. We must deal with it. That's our responsibility as a world leader. The war for these people goes on. The war to establish and maintain their own cultures, to save their way of life, to maintain their own dignity as individuals, their own values. This is a struggle, a daily struggle for them. It continues, it's not over. And tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands have left since 1975 from Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. And they continue to flee today. These people do not leave because they inherently prefer to live in another country, the United States or elsewhere. It's because they have no alternative. They have no options. And only then, and only then, do they leave.
In 4,000 years of history, no Vietnamese took the trouble to try to run away from his land. In 30 years of the most devastating war, as described by the PBS and series among others, not one Vietnamese tried to run away from his land.
One day he was
on the northern side or the southern side, because he'd rather stand his ground, fight, sacrifice and death for a cause in which he believed in. But the communists came, over a million Vietnamese have left their land, despite our great longing
for being where his relatives, friends, and family are this Sunday.
Now, I think this, if nothing else, should tell you the immensity of the time
that event, you know, that
is very much similar
to what happens to during the Second World War when there's population of Jewish people
who had to run away for their lives. As simple as that.
The I'm talking about this young man. He's now only about 30. He's right here in Washington, D.C. And he had to roll his wheelchair. He was a Vietnam veteran, and he lost both legs. And he had to roll his wheelchair 800 miles out of Vietnam, across Cambodia, into Thailand.
Now,
another friend of mine, Nipham,
is
recently has also very such an article in the Reader's Digest.
Now,
he fled by running, bicycling, getting hitchhiked, things like that, from Vietnam
through Cambodia, through
to Thailand,
through Malaysia,
into Singapore,
so something like about
six countries, just mostly walking.
Those who understood that Ho Chi Minh was a communist with area-wide designs had warned Americans of the suffering to come, suffering which is the true legacy of Vietnam.
From a moral point of view, what we were trying to prevent came to pass, and the results were horrendous for the people of Indochina. I don't have to go into details. Everybody's aware of the hundreds of thousands of both people who lost their lives fleeing from Vietnam, from the oppression. Tens of thousands of the people are still in concentration camps in Vietnam. The millions that were killed, and probably the worst example of genocide in modern history, in proportion to the population. And certainly, the Holocaust, in terms of absolute numbers, was greater, but in terms of numbers of people affected, this is the worst example of genocide probably in history. And that was the sort of thing we were fighting to prevent, and lots of us predicted that, and we were laughed at by those who opposed our involvement in the war.
William Stearman was present when the noble effort received its last cruel laugh from the enemy.
So that was the tragedy of the war, is that, as some people say, we
slept
in the jaws of victory. And it would be
not me
to have gone that way. I'm not saying that it would have been easy to have won it, but the South Vietnamese were on their way to winning the war, and they recognized, the North Vietnamese recognized it. But we didn't. We were set up with a war. Henry Kissinger and the president, at that time I was in the White House working for Henry Kissinger, felt that there was no longer public support, and that we had to get the best sort of
deal, and we could.
It turned out to be not very good. There was an Vietnamese violated virtually every article of the peace agreement we signed with them. At the beginning of 73, before the end of July. So they continued violating in a massive way. I was with Kissinger, and we went to Paris to try to work out some more
galleries
for eliminating these violations. This was in June. In June, sister or something, if he's going to continue with the United States, we will have to take military action again. And they leave the North Vietnamese leaders where they were, like 12, and the senior men, the Politburo, and one called Cochran. Now, the Foreign Minister of Vietnam sat back and laughed at us because you evidently don't understand what's going on here in Congress. At that point, I knew the war was lost. The cause was lost. But we couldn't lay a glove on them anymore. They're home free. And they knew what we just sat back and laughed at us. That was the end. You were all out. But we knew it was lost. They just totally ignored you. But finally, negotiated worked out a great victory. Benny admitted it. This report I was referring to by General Han Chen Zoom openly admits they were violating the agreement. They didn't care anymore. They didn't worry about the PR aspects. They admitted they were in the South. The North never admitted they had troops in the South publicly until
however.
They also changed the name of the party from the Workers' Party, the Vietnamese Communist Party. They did that after they succeeded. They didn't worry about that anymore. And deceiving the American public and the rest of the world. They just laughed at us after they won. Laughed at our culpability.
Many who participated in our conference worried that the ubiquity of the PBS series in schools on the air might contribute to repetitions of the errors of our Vietnam debacle. No more Vietnams is a slogan
we see often on
television,
in the press,
and on bumper stickers. Representative John McCain, who spent 6 years in a North Vietnam prison camp, knows from personal experience that the lesson
to be drawn is just
the opposite of that which we find in the WGBH
programs.
The legacy of Vietnam is
with us today. I see it on the
side. You're on the floor in the speeches and the statements.
The
reluctance of the United
States
to understand
that we have our vital national security interests throughout
the world.
And we have an obligation not just to maintain freedom
in the world,
but to maintain our vital national security interests.
The situation in Central America
might be our neighbor, and that in Indochina.
Geography
are
being one
of the primary reasons. Unless we learn
that we have
got to give the kind
of economic aid to the government of El Salvador that's necessary,
we may be paying
again with American lives
in a far more serious
situation closer
to the United States
and El Salvador.
I think that
it's important
to understand that we can't send young
men to die of fright and die
in conflict unless
the goal is
victory.
And at the same time, we can help those nations
which are friends to us,
which are
supporting us,
and that are free nations.
As I believe the government, the freely elected government
of El Salvador
is.
And we need to provide them
aid and support as much as we can
so that we can avoid another commitment of American
troops to
so tragically
enacted in
the China
conflict.
The thing is that we have
that same kind
of
struggle
taking place now in Central America. And
the African people
are giving a misinformation and a
belief
that
the false support
is that somehow the government that
we're fighting
in El Salvador is corrupt and a dictatorship
and
doesn't recognize
human rights. Same thing exactly
as what they got
told us about
South Vietnam. The South
Vietnamese
government was corrupt, didn't have any rights,
and that the
other side
is popular.
If they would lead us to
believe that the Sandinista
government in Nicaragua,
which
won their election by
a gun barrel, and
the only
thing they had
comes out of the barrel of
a gun,
they've
had
no elections,
they have no respect for
human rights, they've persecuted the
Jews
down there, they've been persecuting the Catholics,
they've
massacred
many of the
Mosquito Indians,
But we're not
giving that
kind of
story, and the reason
this is
so critical, if the United
States fails
to meet its
obligations,
Central America, we will
in fact have
probably somewhere between 10 and 20 million refugees
pouring
across our border from Mexico very rapidly.
Because this war
that's going on in Central America. The target is Mexico. The target is not El Salvador. That's where the Soviets are trying to aim their arrows.
It is to stir up the problem on the border of the United States, so it's critical to our future security.
And if we
Americans fail to answer that
call now,
to face
our responsibilities,
we will really drive forward in terms of terrorism, because we have now today
the PLO,
East Germans,
North Koreans, Cubans,
and some Russians, thousands of Cubans, are training people
there. They are
terrorism.
Why?
So that they can infiltrate into the United States with these
refugees, and then
we'll have the war right here on our own.
Our next program will explore how the mass media, especially, are bound up
with our present difficulties
in comprehending today's
challenges abroad.
Vietnam, a television history,
promised
its audience and its
funding
to use
the words of producer
Robert Ellison to strive
for objectivity. The resulting programs did
not fulfill the
promise.
In fact, they only
dredged up the nightly
news melodrama
that
was the Vietnam War
familiar
on TV.
In lieu of history, we have
pop history,
accentuation
and enhancement
of stereotypes,
which will
soon
occur
in college. So to develop a after the Washington conference, from which we obtained
our interviews,
accuracy
in media
reflected a lot between
past misperceptions
and the video history.